On August 15th, following the swift withdrawal of US military forces in Afghanistan, the city of Kabul was taken over by the Taliban. 20 years since the start of the American offensive against Al-Qaeda as a response to the 9/11 attacks, Joe Biden did what his two predecessors had promised but failed to follow through on. He ended America's military involvement in Afghanistan. But the immediate collapse of the Afghan government and military that the US had spent years supporting, as well as the ominous return of the Taliban in power, puts into question whether Biden's decision was the right one. Is putting an end to war always the just thing to do? Should the costs and sacrifices suffered during a war determine whether that war should continue or end? Or should a war only really end when its original aims have been achieved? Welcome to The Philosopher and the News. I'm Alexis Papazoglou. This week, my guest is Darren Mollendorf. He holds the Chair for International Political Theory and Philosophy at Goethe University in Frankfurt am Main, and is one of the few philosophers to engage not only with the question of what makes a war morally justifiable, but more importantly for the purposes of Afghanistan, under what conditions is ending a war the morally right thing to do? Darren Mollendorf, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to start by reading the opening passage of your paper, Ending Wars. And you start by saying, far more often than not, wars are abominations from a moral point of view, massive endeavors, they consume vast amounts of resources and spew out human carnage and devastation, usually for no reason other than the conquest and domination. From the inception, the just war theory tradition has acknowledged that even the few wars that have been just are miserable human practices. So before we go into our main topic for today, namely the conditions under which ending a war is the morally right thing to do, your framing here points to something important when thinking about the morality of war in general, which is that even what might be the morally right thing to do can have huge moral costs. It can be a waste of resources, contribute to human suffering and death and all sorts of other ills. So I just wanted to ask you about this kind of starting point. Is this an attempt by philosophy sort of to acknowledge that it's aware of the realities of war and sort of preempt this accusation that, you know, this is theorizing about something so dark and bleak that, you know, people writing about it from the comfort of their university offices wouldn't really able to, you know, fathom?
I think the just war tradition, or at least the best aspects of the just war tradition, are attempting to acknowledge the realities of war in the sense that wars are, in the vast majority of instances, unjust, and the moral costs of the wars are extraordinary and excessive. And the point of the just war tradition is to constrain the reasons for going to war, to offer another way of looking at that is to offer grounds for criticizing the reasons that leaders of political entities or leaders of state attempt to use to justify going to war. So one of the ways to think about the just war tradition is not the conditions, offering conditions under which a war would be justified, which is, of course, the case, but each of these conditions is also a condition under which a war can be, according to which a war can be criticized. And I think it's that critical aspect of the just war tradition that's the most important feature of it.
Yeah. So instead of sort of giving permission to states to go to war and offering the kind of list of conditions they need to fulfill, is more a sort of list of using this list as a kind of critique of states that go to war and pointing out why most wars are, in fact, unjust.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, Michael Walzer at one point talks about just war theory as a critical theory, and I think that's exactly what he means.
Can you tell us a little bit about what are the kind of conditions that just war theory usually puts forward as having to be fulfilled in order for a war to be considered just?
So it shouldn't surprise you that there's no agreement about this amongst philosophers. I think that this is a matter of significant debate amongst philosophers and moral theologians about what the conditions are, but also about how to understand the conditions that that are agreed upon. And there are four, more often than not, agreed upon conditions. One, the first condition, and it's a condition that I think every account of just war theory accepts, is the idea of just cause. That the thought here is that going to war is a response to an injustice. So there has to be a condition of injustice that justifies the going to war. And what counts as the right kind of injustice, of course, is something that's a matter of significant debate. It also typically is understood that it can't simply be a futile effort, that there has to be a prospect of success. There has to be some, within some sort of threshold of likelihood, success has to be within what's foreseeable. And that the costs that are imposed by going to war have to be proportional to the injustice that the war is meant to remedy. So this is the condition of proportionality. And then fourthly and finally, for these core conditions, is the condition of necessity, that the war has to be the necessary means for remedying the injustice. That is to say that there can't be any less costly means for achieving the rectification of the injustice. This is sometimes referred to as last resort, and last resort is a less precise way of putting it, because it's not a question of time, that this has to come at the end of a series of attempts, but it's a question of there being no other alternative other than war, hence the terminology of necessity. There are other conditions that get discussed, right intention, correct authority, or two others that often are discussed. I think they're more controversial, and that these four are generally agreed upon. But even amongst these four, with the exception of just cause, there's the potential for disagreement about whether or not they're really necessary conditions.
So to revisit your opening quotation from the paper, Ending Wars, you say that, well, given that everyone acknowledges that wars are terrible things, the answer to when a war should end seems to be pretty straightforward. So even if we acknowledge that there are some just wars, and you say, to quote you, the party pursuing a just war should just end the war when the objective has been fulfilled, and the party pursuing an unjust war should cease hostilities immediately, right, end quote. But you say, of course, on reflection, matters are a lot more complicated than that. Why is that? Why isn't it the case that morality demands of us to end unjust wars immediately and end a just war when the original aims of that war are fulfilled?
Well, take the just war first. We assume that the war is just in the sense that it's satisfied whatever we agree to be the conditions that a war has to satisfy in order to be just. But suppose it's the four that I just named. It might be the case that after the war has begun, that suddenly it looks, for a variety of reasons, they could be unexpected defeats, they could be quick changes in the balance of military forces, or what have you. But suddenly it looks like it's much less likely to be successful than it looked to be, reasonably could be expected to be at the beginning of the war. Or it looks like even if it could be successful, it can only be successful at the cost of imposing just massive costs on people who aren't liable to attack. And in that case, we would, I think, have to say that the war no longer satisfies the conditions of likelihood of success or proportionality, and that would suggest that there are reasons to bring the war to an end short of victory. in the case of an unjust war, it will depend upon why it's unjust, but suppose that it's unjust because the likelihood of success at the beginning of the war looks too dim, then the same sorts of considerations could apply. Once the war has begun, there could be unlikely military successes, unlikely military victories that suddenly change the calculation of whether or not the war was unjust. And in that case, you would think that it should be pursued, particularly if the cause is just. If the cause is unjust, if it's an unjust war because the cause is unjust, then that kind of a consideration doesn't apply. And then the question is how to end the pursuit of that unjust cause in a way that will bring about the least costly end to the war. And sometimes achieving the least costly end to the war may require prolonging the war, but only prolonging the war with the goal of bringing about the end of the war.
Yeah, so I think that's the more sort of surprising case, right? The case of when a war might be unjust to begin with, but that in the duration of the war, it might actually become unjust to end the war. So the just thing to do is to continue the war, even though the conditions for starting the war to begin with were not just. It didn't fulfill the usual kind of criteria. Can you give us an example of a war like that? In your paper, you offer a couple of examples. One of them sounds uncannily like what the USA did after 9/11 by going into Afghanistan. And of course, this is the issue at the background of this conversation.
There's a way of interpreting the Afghan war that fits this well. And the US invasion, or the US-led invasion of Afghanistan, was widely thought by most people, I think, to be a just war, but not uniformly so. And in fact, when at the beginning of the war, I wrote a paper that that doubted whether it was a war of necessity, doubted whether there may not be other ways to disarm al-Qaeda if that was the point of the war, and doubted that it could be achieved within reasonable costs, that both the likelihood of success and proportionality were satisfied. I think it was these. Whenever one criticizes a war on those grounds, one's dealing with difficult empirical questions, unlike the question of just cause. But I thought at the time that there was reasons to doubt the justice of the war at that on those grounds. Assume that was right at that time. Once the war began, some of those questions might fall away. So. It might be the case that the question of last resort, which the war might have been vulnerable to criticism from at the beginning of the war, because there may have been diplomatic means other than war to pursue the end, this might not be available any longer once the war has begun, because the diplomatic channels have been broken. And so in a case like that, if the criticism of the war at the beginning was that it wasn't a war of necessity, that simply may not apply once the war has begun. So we're assuming in this case that just cause has been satisfied. And if the primary criticism of the war is that it's not unnecessary war, that just may not apply once the war has begun. And one's attitude towards the war can change given changed circumstances as the war is prosecuted.
So the main claim that you're making in this paper is that the sort of the morality of continuing a war and the moral considerations that come with that is a distinct kind of question and a distinct issue from the morality of resorting to war in the first place. So as we've said, the question of whether a war was started for just reasons is almost irrelevant to the question of whether that war should end. And you call this the independence thesis. Can you say a little bit more about it? And can you answer to a critique of this position? You mentioned Seth Lazar, who argues that actually, you know, whether you should keep on fighting or whether you should start fighting to begin with is kind of the same question, right? And am I morally justified in taking up arms? And am I morally justified in laying down my arms? Can't be seen as you know, different questions. They're essentially the same question. So tell us a little bit more about this independence thesis and this kind of objection to it.
Yeah. So the independence thesis is exactly what we've been discussing up to this point, which is to say that the question of whether it was just to begin the war doesn't determine the answer to the question of whether or not it's just to continue the war. The continuance of the war, the answer to the question of the continuance of the war is independent of the answer to the question of the initiation of the war, whether the war was at initiation thought of as just or unjust. And there's a sense in which what Lazar is saying there, of course, is exactly right. The question is whether or not to prosecute violence, and that's true. The point, though, of the idea that these are independent is that the answer to the first question, whether to begin the war, doesn't determine the answer to the second question, whether to continue the war. In that sense, they're distinct questions. They're not distinct in that they're concerned about different things. They're both concerned about the morality of violence, and in particular the violence of war. But they're distinct in the sense that the answers to the questions are logically distinct.
As always, this podcast is created in partnership with The Philosopher, the UK's longest-running public philosophy journal. The new issue of The Philosopher is out on the theme of concept and reality. Amy Thomason opens the issue with an expansive overview of philosophy as conceptual engineering, while Peter Wolfendale clarifies the issues over the role philosophers should be playing in debates over the status of social concepts like race and gender. To order your copy and subscribe to the magazine, go to www.thephilosopher1923.org. One of the big questions surrounding this issue of whether it's just to end a war or not has to do with taking into account the costs already incurred during a war. So this is very relevant at the moment, right? So now that the US has left Afghanistan, many are pointing out to the sort of tragedy of there having been 20 years wasted resources and lives lost for the situation in Afghanistan to return to what it was more or less before the US intervened, and are wondering whether, you know, it would have been better to stay in the country a little bit longer. And this, of course, was a very alive political dilemma in 2015 when Barack Obama was making the case for leaving Afghanistan. John McCain made exactly that argument. He said, and I quote him, "All of us want the war in Afghanistan to be over, but after 20 years of hard-fought gains, the decisions we make now will determine whether our progress will endure and our sacrifices won't be in vain." So this is similar to the so-called sunk costs fallacy, if I'm not mistaken. So allowing the kind of costs of a decision already incurred to determine whether we should keep going with something or not, independently of the extra costs that might be incurred in the future. So given that this sort of frame of thinking is very prevalent at the moment, what is wrong with that way of thinking when it comes to thinking about ending a war?
Right. I mean, I think that the problem, of course, with, as I see it at least, with that way of thinking about past costs, is it puts the war on a trajectory in which no amount of costs incurred can be used as a reason for ending the war. If 5 years later more costs have been incurred and the prospects for ending the war look just as slim, the same argument will be made at that particular point. And so that approach is an approach that evacuates a critical category that we typically want to use for evaluating the morality of the war, which is whether or not the good that the war would bring about is sufficient to outweigh the costs that are incurred. And this is something that we ask about wars, and I think it's something that we rightly ask about wars. We're engaged in this practice precisely because of the horror of a war that we started this discussion with, we ask ourselves whether or not this horrible practice is one that is worth or can be justified by the good that it's going to bring about. And that has to include the reflection of the costs that have already been incurred. And when one takes the view that McCain is taking in that quotation, you're just not able to do that.
And what about the reverse kind of thinking? I mean, it seems like you can also take the opposite view, suggesting that, you know, we should just forget about past costs. We can't change those. They're in the past. We should only be thinking about, you know, potential future costs to something and whether, you know, the benefits would result from continuing with the war, fulfilling perhaps its original purpose, outweigh those future costs. And you argue in your paper that framework is also problematic. Why is that?
I mean, it's interesting that turns out practically to be the same position, right? In both cases, the costs that have been incurred up to that point don't matter for the continued evaluation of whether or not the war should be prosecuted. In one case, because the cost can only be counted positively, that we've incurred so many costs that we have to continue along the way. And in the other case, because we just don't count the costs at all and we start with a fresh slate. But in neither case can we use the past costs as a reason to reject continued prosecution of the war. And my answer to the view that we should just fully discount past costs is that it's twofold. One is that the concept of proportionality, as I understand it, as a concept in the theory of jus ad bellum. Jus ad bellum is the doctrine of whether or not, or is the set of concerns about whether or not it's just a resort to war. The concept of proportionality, as I understand it, is that in securing the good that the just cause is aiming towards, there has to be some limit to the permissible cost imposition. And conceptions of proportionality will differ according to how to understand what that limit is, how to understand what are the relevant costs. But the idea is that there's some limit to the cost that can be imposed. And if one fully discounts past costs at the moment of deliberation, sometime further on when the war has begun and one's engaged in what I call the jus ex bello exercise of considering whether or not to continue the war, if one fully discounts the past costs, then there's no in principle limit to the amount of costs that can be imposed in the pursuit of the war. One might say, well, we've exceeded the costs that we reasonably said at the beginning of the war. We had what I'll call a proportionality budget. We said that the achievement of this just cause is only worth the imposition of this amount of costs. And we thought that we could achieve the just cause within that limit. Turns out that we couldn't. We've come up against the limit. And then the question is, can we continue? And if we say, well, yeah, we should be able to continue because it looks like now at this point we'll be able to achieve the end of the just cause within a new proportionality budget. And then turns out after a period of time passes that we've come up against the limit of the second proportionality budget and we're asking ourselves the same question. And you can see how it looks like there's just no longer an in principle stopping point to the imposition of costs in the pursuit of the just cause when we think about the costs measured over the entire course of the war. So it's a view that I think is in tension with, more strongly put, in contradiction with the concept of proportionality. But even if you don't accept that, and not everybody does. Even if you don't accept that, I think the other problem with that kind of approach is the way that I answered the sort of McCain view, which for most of us, our practice of engaging in moral reflection about any particular war includes considering the costs of that war up to that point. It's a big part of the sort of the practice of moral evaluation of wars to think about whether or not the war is worth the cost that it's imposing. And if we don't allow ourselves to look back and consider the costs that have been imposed up to this point, if we just fully discount all the past costs, I think we're losing an important critical perspective on war. I think it's inconsistent with the practice that we engage in and that we rightly engage in when we think about whether or not the horrible costs of war are worth it.
Can I ask you a question about that? So this whole sort of discussion is in a way premised on the idea that you can, before you go into war, sort of budget morally for the costs. How do you even go about doing that? Like, what would be the method of saying, well, this war's aim is worth, 1,000 lives and, a destruction of the economy of the country by 30%, say? Like, how does one even go about doing that? Is that kind of moral calculus a bit sort of absurd?
Yeah, I mean, this is an excellent question. And of course, the whole discussion assumes that there's some sense in doing that. Any attempt to do it, of course, is very rough and very approximate. But more than that, there are different conceptions of proportionality that will guide us in the effort of what we're actually doing when we engage, even in a very rough approximation of that kind of a calculation. So you might think that, well, what we're worried about essentially is the costs that are imposed on people who aren't liable to the imposition of the costs. In traditional just war theory, this is thought of as civilians, as non-combatants. Jeff McMahon has sort of urged us to think differently about this and to think about it in terms of whether or not people are liable to the imposition of the costs. These may be soldiers, they may be not civilians, but the sort of central idea is the question of liability to the imposition of the costs. And that one conception is, well, it's a sort of question of weighing how many people will be subjected to these costs against the good of the achievement of the just cause. And it's a kind of, we're engaged in a process, according to this way of thinking about it, we're engaged in a process of projecting what the costs would be for the achievement of the end and weighing those costs against the good of the end. And it's a kind of an impersonal disvalue weighed against an impersonal value. And we look for the equilibrium point in which the costs don't exceed the value. That's a kind of, I think that the language of proportionality tends to lend itself to that way of thinking about what proportionality is about, but I don't think it's the only way to think about what proportionality is about. I think one can take a less consequentialist approach to thinking about what proportionality is about and ask, what principle for the weighing of costs could people reasonably accept when we think about the costs then not as costs of impersonal value, but as costs to people to whom we owe a justification of some sort? And then there will be discussions about what the principle would be that would be the measure of those costs. But there's no reason to think that the principle would simply be the weighing of impersonal costs against the impersonal value of the good achieved. So you put your finger on a question about proportionality that I think has not been discussed enough, and it simply points to an area that in which there needs to be a lot more work, I think.
Mm. Are there examples of past wars that people theorizing about this think meet the criteria that they set out? So, in other words, what are the just wars of the past that philosophers can point as kind of examples that, you know, if you have to go to war, it should look like this?
Well, I guess this will, of course, depend upon whether or not we're thinking about this from the perspective of before the war began, and the question is the jus ad bellum question of whether or not to initiate the war. But most people who think about war who aren't pacifists, who don't think that all wars are unjust, will point to wars like the American involvement in World War II, or perhaps the cause of the American North and the Civil War as potentially at least antebellum prior to the beginning of the war, just wars,
mm-hmm. But not necessarily in terms of how they continued and what their outcome was.
I should have mentioned this earlier. You asked me a sort of a general question about just war and about what just war theory is, and there's a distinction that's typically made in these discussions between the justification of a war and the conditions that are needed to justify resorting to war, on the one hand, and then the practices that are engaged upon in the pursuit of the war. So the former is typically referred to, at least in the recent tradition of just war theory, as jus ad bellum, and the second is usually referred to as jus in bello. And jus in bello are the considerations of what's justified to do in the pursuit of a just war. What kinds of practices can be employed in the pursuit of the just war? I argue for a third view, the view of jus ex bello, that is whether or not a war should be continued, and if not, how it should be ended. And then there's a fourth view that philosophers in the last 15 or 20 years have been developing called jus post bellum, which has to do with the conditions of peace, what can be done in the peace immediately after the war.
Can we bring it back to the current moment and ask, at least very broadly, in terms of what you've been witnessing in Afghanistan, how does everything that you know about just war theory and ending wars in a just way fit into this picture? So the main argument in favor of the U.S. staying longer in Afghanistan seems to be that, well, irrespective of whether the U.S. achieved the goals of its original intervention in the country, irrespective of whether those goals were just and the war was just, let's assume that, you know, the end goal was rooting out Al-Qaeda and that, you know, goal was achieved, let's say. The very act of leaving the country now has led to a certain degree of chaos and will lead to, you know, human suffering and so on. And Joe Biden's defense of the move is to argue that it would have happened whenever the US decided to leave, that this kind of level of chaos would be inevitable. Now, again, let's assume that's true. Of course, lots of people dispute that. If that is the case, does it follow that, you know, morality would demand of the US that it should remain in Afghanistan forever to avoid the kind of level of human suffering that we're seeing now?
Right. The easiest way for you and I to talk about this is the way that you've set it up, which is good. That is, we have to make certain empirical assumptions about these matters. And part of the problem, of course, is that these are always against the backdrop of counterfactuals, and we can often wonder about that. I've said in my thinking about the idea of jus ex bello that there are two main questions to ask. One question is whether or not the war should be continued, and the other question is if it shouldn't, how it should be ended. And I think with respect to the war in Afghanistan, the question of whether or not it should be continued, when Biden went on TV and he talked about the costs of the war up to that point, doing what I think is legitimate, that is invoking the costs of the war up to that point in a way that some philosophers don't think is legitimate. I think that that was right to highlight those costs. I think it's important to highlight those costs. I think the mistake that he made was that the costs that he highlighted were the costs that were solely expressed solely in the terms of the loss of U.S. military lives. He said that, you know, over 2,000 American soldiers had died in the war. That's relevant, but that can't be the most relevant consideration because it completely neglects the lives of Afghani civilians that died in the war as well. And that's nearly 48,000, according to at least to some figures. So it's terribly costly. And I guess it should be mentioned also, not only is it terribly costly, but the costs have been increasing in those terms. So in 2008, somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 people died in the war. And in 2019, it was close to 30,000. The costs have been, there's been an upward trend of the number of lives that have been lost since 2008. So it's not going in the right direction. Not only is it not going in the right direction, there's, as I think everybody agrees, there's no clear end in sight. So these are strong reasons, I think, that that argue in favor of saying that the war just simply can't satisfy the condition of likelihood of success, or even if it can, it seems not to be the case that it could satisfy the condition of likelihood of success within acceptable moral costs. That is, if it can satisfy that condition, it can't satisfy the condition of proportionality. These are reasons, I think, compelling reasons to think that the war should be ended. That the general conclusion that it's time to end the war is probably the right conclusion. But then that raises the second question, which is how to end the war. And I've tried to develop some principles for this. I don't think these are exhaustive. I think that there must be other principles, but I've come up with five principles. One is the principle that it should be ended as quickly as possible, the principle of what I call all due haste. If the war is unjust, then clearly the continued prosecution of an unjust war is something that needs to, as quickly as possible, be ended. But there are limitations on doing that, constraints on how it should be done. One is in what I call the principle of injustice mitigation, that one can perpetrate injustices in an effort to end a war too quickly. And these have to be balanced against the aim of ending it quickly. And this is, I think, part of what people are concerned about right now in Afghanistan, that the people who came to be protected by the United States, came to trust the United States, who are involved in the effort. These are translators and other people who work with the United States military personnel. It seemed to be left very vulnerable by the way that the war has ended. Now, the extent to which the United States is at fault here is, I think, difficult to assess. Could the United States have reasonably expected that they would be in this situation, that the country would fall so quickly? Nobody seems to think that that this was foreseeable, at least that the fall was foreseeable this quickly. And then there's Biden's own justification for not doing more sooner, which was that the Afghan president asked him not to do more sooner because he thought that this would just perpetuate the decline of the country. People would come to believe that it was a lost cause and that would weaken the morale even further. Is that plausible? Is that something that should be taken into consideration? Should this mitigate our judgment that the United States should have done more? Maybe. I think it's very difficult to assess. There's no denying that this is an enormous human tragedy for the people who are trapped there. The extent to which it might have been avoided by a different policy, it's very hard, at least for somebody in a position like me with the limited knowledge that I have of the situation, to assess. So whether or not injustice mitigation has been satisfied, I don't know. I think it's It's easy to say that it hasn't, but I'm reticent to pronounce on that so decisively. There are three others that I'll just mention quickly because I suspect we want to get on. But if a war is in pursuit of a just cause, then there's this idea, this principle of what I call moral cost minimization. So in the ending of the war, one should try to preserve as much as can be preserved in the achievement of the just cause, perhaps even in the way in which the war has ended, try to achieve more. And then in the negotiations for ending the war, good faith in the peace negotiations, I think, is important when they exist. And in the course of those negotiations, if there are such negotiations, that parties to the war should not make claims on the basis of conquest during the war. So those are what I call the five principles that that I've developed, waiting for others to develop or to augment to those principles for the question of how war should be ended.
I kind of want to return, since we're kind of coming to a close here, to one of my first questions to you, which is a sort of criticism that all this moral theorizing, thinking about how wars should start and end in an ideal world that still has wars, is just too removed from reality. That, you know, real politics is never about morality and justice. It's about power and influence and special interests. And that all this discussion has no real contact with how war actually happens and how war actually ends, what countries really feel restrained by. Do you think this is a fair criticism, or do you think that it's too cynical?
Yeah, this is a sort of realist criticism of just war theory in general. And I think that citizens look for ways to hold their leaders accountable, and they look for ways in which the pursuit of power can be checked and the moral reasons for why it should be checked. And I see the doctrines of just war theory as part of that practice, as a practice in which power, people try to constrain power, by morality. And I think it's very important, certainly not always effective. Actually probably more often than not effective. But in our efforts to try to bring unchecked power under control, what we seek are good moral reasons for doing so. And the criterion of just war theory in three or four of its areas are part of that effort.
So it's a kind of trying to shame our leaders into you know, behaving in a way that's more in accordance with morality by holding them accountable.
Yeah, I'm not sure shame is the right word. I mean, shame might be part of the process, but we seek reasons to engage politically and to mobilize politically and to constrain power. And shaming might be one way to constrain power, but political mobilization is another way, and political campaigning is another way. And these are efforts that need to be supported with good reasons, and the theories of just war are attempts to offer good moral reasons for doing so.
Okay, one penultimate question, a bit sort of more lighthearted. I saw someone on Twitter mention that, you know, the Second World War hasn't really ended because there are troops in Germany, there are US troops in Germany, and there are US troops in Japan. And, you know, what are they doing there other than trying to keep the peace and, you know, stop from something like that happening again? Do you think that observation is getting at something?
So I guess the I guess the thought is that wars never end, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I suppose this person might say the North is still occupying the South as well in the United States. I don't take that seriously. I mean, I think the reasons for those troops in those countries don't have anything to do with the presence of the force that they were fighting against at the time, but rather they have to do with larger questions of the balance of geopolitical forces.
And the final question: what's a book that you would recommend to listeners for better understanding just war theory and, you know, all its parameters, including how a war should end?
Well, there are two books, I suppose, that I would recommend. The classic book of the 20th century is Michael Walzer's Just and Unjust Wars. I think it's still an important book to read. And then the more recent debates on just war theory have been strongly influenced, profoundly influenced by Jeff McMahon's book in, I think it was 2008, Killing in War. And that's an important book if you want to understand where a lot of just war thinking is these days, or at least what it's responding to.
Darren Wollendorf, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Philosopher in the News. If you enjoyed this episode, I have a favour to ask. Please go over to Apple Podcasts. The link is in the show notes. And tell me what you liked about it. Your feedback will inform future episodes and also help other listeners of podcasts find the show. I'm Alexis Papazoglou, and this was The Philosopher in the News. Speak again soon.